Hello, and welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Lolly Davidson is an author of fiction and nonfiction and a distinguished professor at SUNY Adirondack, where she teaches fiction writing, public speaking, and composition. Her stories have appeared in the North American Review, Eclectica, Big Lux, and The Collagist, among others. Her story, The Opal Maker, was named Top 50 of 2015 by Wigleaf, and her fiction chapbook, Strange Appetites, won the Adirondack Center for Writing People's Choice Award in 2016. I visited her home in Saratoga Springs to see the final performance of her latest work, Uprising, a play about the Polish resistance to Nazi occupation in World War II. Lolly wrote Uprising in collaboration with two teenagers, Katie LaCours and Grace Alberti, who also directed. My wife Wendy and Lolly went to Oberlin together, and I've known Lolly and her husband Charlie Brown and daughter Tess Davidson Brown for close to 20 years. We often discuss writing, spirituality, and politics. And this week, Lolly and I are sharing one of our chats with you. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Lolly.
Hi.
I'm here in Saratoga Springs.
Horse race country.
Bastion of people who are deeply living.
Deeply living. Some of us are.
Yeah, trying. Yeah, we were just talking about the different kinds of work that you do. You're a writer, but you also teach writing.
Yes.
At Adirondack.
At SUNY Adirondack Community College.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And we got a little intrigued about the students and what they're about these days, because there's so much talk in the news about young people and young people being a this or a that, or trying to get them to get out and vote. And,
what's
been your impression of the people you work with?
I'm actually fairly optimistic about our young people. You had mentioned this, and I had heard there was an author who just came out with a book on millennials. And he was saying a lot of things about millennials that I didn't agree. He was being interviewed on Bill Maher. And he was saying how much time they spent on the screen, how they're a lot more depressed, this was interesting. He was saying they don't go out drinking a lot and they don't drive cars a lot. And, he was saying that like it was a problem. But then when he did say that there was the incidence of suicide seemed to be higher, had gone up by some alarming rate, and he gave the percentage of what had gone up by, but he didn't really give us the numbers. So it sounded really scary, but I realized it was like, it was, if the suicide rate is 10%, it had gone up to 20% or something, So that's worrisome, but he was attributing it to this kind of, the way that they all communicate through their phones. They don't go out because they're all connected via their phones and via Instagram and whatnot. And I thought, gee, that's not, first of all, is that a bad thing that they're not going out and drinking and, they're not having a lot of sex apparently. And I was like, is that a bad thing that they're waiting to have sex? Like maybe they're actually kind of sensible, you know? And then Bill Maher said, oh, but these are private college students, right? And he was like, oh yeah. And I thought, oh, well, that explains why it doesn't match my impression of them, because I'm dealing with community college students, which are a really distinct group of people who, they're usually, they're often lower income bracket or non-traditional students who, they maybe started a career and then they're switching careers, or they already have children and they never had a career and they're trying to get back in, into the work realm. Often they are students who really were checked out in high school. They often have, addiction in their families, like their parents were drug addicts or they were caregivers. Like these kids have been taking care of their siblings or their grandparents sometimes. They're often missing class because they have to drive their grandparents to the hospital.
Right.
So that's the kind of kids that I'm dealing with.
Do you find that a lot of them are in school like not with that liberal arts education purpose. Like, yeah. I'm not coming here just to enrich myself, but I'm actually coming here because I think it's going to bring me
a job. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're very practical, you know, so it's really about, you know, they would not take this time out of work and spend this money on education unless it was going to lead to a job. The idea of education for education's sake, I don't think that ever would occur to them. And also it would seem like crazy, like, you know, they need jobs. Mm-hmm. So often the whole concept of education is a bit of a hard sell because it feels to them like it's been something that has been put upon them and they've been forced into it, even though it's technically a choice. It really isn't, because everybody requires at minimum a BA for even low wage, even like at Target. I mean, I guess you don't have to have a BA to work at Target, but you have to be at least 18 now, you know, and you, to get anywhere, you have to have at minimum a BA. So I think they feel kind of coerced and angry about that. And then a lot of them really can't focus, or they never could focus. Like, the reason why they were checked out in high school was because they were dealing with all this emotional stuff that made it impossible to focus. And we know from studies that there's this term that everybody, this becomes sort of au courant, the bandwidth term. And it's, you know,
how much bandwidth do you have?
Yeah. And it, you know, it's a problematic term because it's using a machine, you know, analogy to compare to your brain. But I do think it's a little bit convenient, because I do think there is this, you know, the brain is receiving and giving, and all these messages are kind of bouncing around. And if a lot of those, that activity is being taken up by worry over your sick grandmother and your brother who's doing drugs, you know, you don't have a lot left to absorb any information about what's happening in biology class. Right. And that's just, they can prove that people's, I guess it was on one of these cognitive, I think the brain podcast, he was saying they actually did a test on your IQ, and they found that Farmers in India who, when their harvest comes in, it usually comes in once a year. And so they'll be flush with money. And then by the end of the year, they're poor. Right. So you can test their cognitive ability during that poor period and during their, and it's the same group of people.
Right.
And they found that their IQ really drops.
Wow.
And they make bad decisions when they are under stress. So, you know, these students are all dealing with that. But by and large, I have found them to be more liberal, even though even the ones that are Republican, they're more accepting of gay people. They are not overtly racist, you know. They get resentful at being accused of being racist.
But I think that's a really common trait.
Yeah.
You know, that all of us, we all think we're doing things well. We're living well. We're making the right choices. We're thoughtful and all that. So to be accused of something then really gets you defensive.
Yeah. And to be accused of something that you think is really evil.
Right.
I mean, I think in a way that defensiveness comes from a, like, oh my God, to be racist is to be a bad person.
Right.
How dare you call me a bad person?
But I think that that points out that we have this cultural norm of racism, you know, that's that institutionalized racism.
Yeah.
So there needs to be education around that
somehow. And then there's that uneasiness that, like, but if I admit that, if I buy the fact that there's institutionalized racism, that I'm getting some preferential treatment just because of the color of my skin, and I can't even get my foot in the door in a job.
Right.
And you're telling me I'm privileged.
Right.
Again, that's very hard to swallow.
Right.
You know?
And that's, I think, where a lot of this frustration that Trump tapped into comes from.
Yeah.
People who kept hearing the economy's great.
Yeah.
Well, wait, my economy's not great.
Right.
And, you know, and these other people deserve something because they're an underclass.
Yeah.
Well, wait, what about me?
Yeah.
So
there's a, but I guess what I'm finding is, you know, my, you know, particular, the demographic of students that comes to SUNY Adirondack tend to be pretty gritty. Like, they have been knocked down many, many times, and they just stand up and keep going. And so they may fail college three or four times in the course of 4 years, but they keep coming back and trying again. Wow. Even with brain damage and things like that, they Wow. keep coming back and trying again. You can, you know, so I just find that that's a really different group, a different kind of behavior patterns. And I find them to be mostly really fairly easy to work with, fairly respectful mm-hmm. of me personally, not so much respectful of education. And then that's just more a matter of trying to convince them of the validity and the need for education. Mm-hmm. So I try to give them a lot of examples of places where education made a life or death difference mm-hmm. in my life. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I often will tell them the story of Tess, of my daughter, that I don't think she'd be here if I wasn't an educated person. Mm. When I got pregnant with, I miscarried, and the doctors are like, oh, miscarriage, that's normal. Like, oh, don't worry about it. Just try again. Like, and I was like, well, huh, it's not a normal pattern in my family. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh yeah, no, you know, we don't start doing testing until you miscarry two or three times. And I think because I came from an educated place, I was just like, had a certain sense of entitlement of like, what? Mm-hmm. You're going to make me go through this two or three times mm-hmm. before you think it's worth doing a test? Like, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I have insurance. Are you trying to save my insurance company money? And you're thinking that me having two more miscarriages is an okay
cost?
Yeah. You know? And so I sat them down. I was just like, tell me what the tests are. So then I kind of had to, you know, beat on the counter and a little bit to get them to come and talk to me. And so a doctor came in and he spent an hour with me and he just rattled off all the different tests. And again, I think somebody who's not educated, who feels intimidated, would have been like, well, what do you think, doctor? Mm-hmm. But again, because I'm kind of from this place of like, I can do this. I can listen. I can make sense of difficult things.
Right.
Yeah. And I can trust my brain.
Right.
I listened to them all and I said, well, doesn't it make sense to start with the easiest and the cheapest and least invasive mm-hmm. test? So let's try a blood test, you know, because mm-hmm. let's do a blood test before we do a biopsy. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, first test, they found out wow. I have this weird syndrome called antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, which means that I have basically...
And because of your education.
And because of...
That.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, they were like, oh, yeah, you have this thing, but it's not really the typical thing, and it's not really that bad. So we just think you should try again mm-hmm. and see what happens. And again, I was just like, that just sounds bad. So I went to my library's database that, you know, at the college where I work, and I knew how to find the one that was for the nurses. And I looked it up, and then, you know, there's all this gobbledygook and all mm-hmm. this testing results and numbers and graphs. And, you know, I waded into it. And again, I think this is all because I had confidence in my ability to read difficult texts and boring texts. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing is that students will always say, you know, it's boring. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, but your life could depend on whether or not you can read your insurance policy,
yeah.
which is really boring.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what I found out was, yes, I did have this second kind. The first form of this, the molecule is so small it could get right through the placenta and kill the fetus. It thinks the fetus is an infection and it will kill the fetus. But I had the second kind, which was a bigger molecule that couldn't make it through the placenta, but it would try.
Mm.
And that I had like only a 20% chance of success unless it was treated. And the treatment was injections of, I think it was warfarin, which is a blood thinner.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was mm-hmm. a blood thinner. And you had to inject yourself twice a day, and it had no impact on the fetus. So I found all this out
yeah.
from the research.
You found it out.
I yeah. found it out. They didn't explain it to me.
Yeah.
And I went back to the doctor, and I was like, why wouldn't you treat me?
Right.
And they were just like, well, we just don't think it's important. So I said, well, I went to a different doctor. And when I got pregnant again, the doctor tested me and he said, yeah, I'm looking at your numbers and I think you should be treated for this. So that was, you know, step one. So the whole pregnancy, I had to inject myself morning and night. And the, you know, baby was small, you know, all the way through. So I had to do a lot of ultrasounds, but you know, normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing that happened that I think, you know, could have threatened my pregnancy is... The doctor calls me, this is the new doctor, and he says, you know, we did the Down syndrome test and your numbers are really not good.
Mm.
It's like 1 in 60, which is, that's hot. That's, I mean, it's, you want it to be like 1 in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any questions? And I was like, well, yeah. How do you arrive at that number? And he was irritated at me. He was like, well, why do you want to know? I'm like, I thought you just asked me if I had questions. I do, actually. So I said, well, because I like to understand it so I can make decisions about my body. And he was like, well, you should just come in. So it was a 45-minute drive, and I was, you know, driving the whole way, just like, you know, okay, try not to get upset about this, try not to worry. So I had made friends with the lab technician. I said, can I just look at my report? And she was like, sure. And I looked at the report, and I'm trying to find that number, the 60. And I'm looking all over, and I said, I don't see that number. Where's that number? And she says, right there. And she, oh, it's 260. So this is good, right? So I'm like, okay, this is good. So my chances are now better of having a child that doesn't have Downs. And then I keep looking at him, just, and I don't know what I'm looking for. It was just like, well, let me just make sure that I understand all of this. Look at the date. The date of the fetus is wrong. And I said, this is wrong. You've got the date of the fetus wrong. And she's like, what? No, no, I'm sure that's not, that we couldn't have made a mistake on that. And I'm like, it's wrong. She's like, oh, well, you should meet with a high-risk pregnancy doctor anyway. So I meet with the high-risk pregnancy doctor anyway, like this is a week or two later. And he goes, blah, 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 amniocentesis this, amniocentesis that, risk to the fetus this, blah, blah, blah. Any questions? And I said, yeah, if the date of the fetus is wrong, what does this mean for this test result? And he was like, oh, what? And he looks at the both, you know, he starts, you know, flipping through my folder and my file, and he says, oh, my gosh, it means these results mean nothing.
Oh, wow.
We need to recalculate.
Oh, wow.
So they recalculated, and I was like coming up normal, normal risks. So I didn't need an amniocentesis. So
amazing. Yeah.
I really think she wouldn't have been there.
So you tell that story in your class.
I do. I tell that story in my class. It's like, this
is. And what do they say? Are they like.
They're pretty impressed. I don't know if it convinces them to do their homework the next day, but I think they get it. You know, they get that education isn't just about reading these weird abstract things that have nothing to do with your life. And that it really is a, I mean, that's what I keep pushing. This is about teaching a habit of mind, a critical thinking habit of mind, and, you know, having that sense of confidence in yourself that you can question authority.
Right.
And question them well.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think our whole society questions authority, but we don't necessarily know what critical thinking is as a society.
Yeah,
so we just reject, you know, that.
Yes, Professor.
Yeah.
Preet Bharara was just interviewing Jeffrey Toobin on his podcast. And Toobin was talking about watching a tweet come from Trump. And it was, I'm trying to think what was the, I'm forgetting the specific which tweet it was, but the president's response to some news that was, you know, relatively important and critical of his administration was, I saw it. It's no big deal, and it's boring. And and Toobin, who had been the prosecutor in New York, in one of the districts of New York, and Bharara was also, you know, Southern District prosecutor, said, yeah, you know, that's usually a good defense when the lawyer comes up and says, this evidence isn't important and it's boring. So you just throw the case out.
And it's boring.
Yeah.
I say this to my students. That's the other thing, is that there's no such thing as boring, or there's no such thing as laziness. That, you know, when you experience boredom, or when you experience a sense of laziness, that what you're really experiencing is a sense of disconnection. And so your job is to try to find a connection, and then you'll find it more interesting.
Now, so what another thing that's been interesting to me about the way that you teach writing in your class is that your topics are really broad, right?
Yeah, I try to let them have their own topics as much as possible. I mean, sometimes you can't, because if you want to all read the same text, you got to, so that's hard. But in classes like my speech classes and my creative writing classes, I give them the form, like, you know, you write an informative speech or write a persuasive speech, but the topic can be anything. And my only criteria is it has to be something that you think matters, that first of all matters to you, and that you think should matter to other people or will matter to other people. So
there's their potential to get the connection for themselves.
Yeah. So it can't be, you know, don't give me a speech on how to make Betty Crocker cake, you know, just because it's easy. So that actually works pretty well. And sometimes I'll set the tone with, we'll do a, you know, the This I Believe program. I think it was Edward R. Murrow started this program in the 1950s where people make these little speeches about their core values. And they're wonderful. And they tell a little story about, you know, what where that value came from. So sometimes I'll start the semester with that. And that's really uplifting because at the end of it, you hear all these people with really fabulous values. Like it really restores your faith in humanity. And
I'd like to talk today about supporting me on Patreon. It's important because I use Patreon to fund Peter's podcast instead of running ads. I figured, why make you listen to me telling you to buy things I don't care about and you don't want, when I could instead ask you to, in effect, buy Peter's podcast? Patreon makes it so easy to buy Peter's podcast. You go to patreon.com/peterspodcast and click on options and fill stuff out. You know how the internet works. Please do it now. Thanks.
I think, you know, that's what's so disturbing about what's going on across the country is that, you know, we're on both sides vilifying the other side, and it's really easy to do. I mean, you know, I've had to ask myself many times, gee, are the Republicans in Congress and the Senate right now kind of evil because they're allowing this despot free reign? But I don't actually think they are. I think, you know, if we could somehow get back to what we really care about, we'd find that we do care about things like kindness. We do care about things like heritage. We care about, you know, things that we can all relate to. It's just that how we implement those and, you know. And then sometimes there's no line, you know, okay, we all believe in kindness except when it comes to welfare. And then suddenly we get angry, you know, and the whole kindness concept goes away. So sometimes there's a disconnect between the core value and how it's expressed politically. But if we could get back to that realization and say, look, we agree on these things, you know.
But, you know, to me, it always seems to boil down to there's a disconnect in the education around these kinds of topics. Like it's one thing to disagree with something where you both have the same story.
Yeah.
Like say, well, yeah, I think that giving welfare to somebody is going to do this. So then there's a test of that through, you know, people who are using state of the art techniques to test it. And then at the end, you have a result, and then you could say, well, I agree with your result, but I don't want to pay for it. So that would be an argument. You know?
Right, right.
But to what's going on, it seems more and more now, is a total, we're not sharing the same set of facts.
Right.
So you're arguing, it's like shouting past each other. And that's, to me, we talked about this a little at dinner last night, about this fake news, which news is fake, you know?
Right, it's like, and the whole idea of there being alternate facts.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a tough thing because the more you go, the deeper you go into anything, the more complex it gets and the less absolutes you're going to find. So it's true. There's only facts. There aren't alternate facts and facts, you know, but another thing that's true is that if you look at something through one lens, you'll focus on particular facts that you'll understand, you'll conclude certain things from those facts. And if you put a different lens on it, it's going to highlight a different set of facts to which you could then attach a different set of values. So I think that's what's going on with the facts and the alternate facts. And then also complexity. And that's another thing I try to teach my students is having some... they get very frustrated with it because they've all been having, well, I was going to finish my sentence, it's important to have some understanding that learning will be uncomfortable.
Hmm.
And that when you start to dig into something, that you will experience a confusion and that the answer will not be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And that there may be several answers and that there's not a clear right or wrong. And that, and having some, getting comfortable with the messiness of life is really important, you know, because for one thing, it makes you understand there's always more to the story, you know, than what you knew,
yeah,
or what you found out, and that you should never just accept it the face value. But that's disturbing because nobody likes to be uncomfortable. Nobody likes to be confused.
Mm-hmm.
And also their education, I don't want to blame like the K through 12 teachers, but you know, because politicians have been forcing us to do these kinds of standardized tests,
mm-hmm,
it has kind of forced education into this teaching to the test mode.
Yeah.
It's unnecessary.
We have it even in yoga where I will get a student who's maybe been studying somewhere else, comes to our school where we're very individualized in terms of how we interpret the practice to the person.
Yeah.
And they'll say, is this right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, it depends, you know.
It's, yeah, it's, what you're trying to achieve.
And they're, it's such a shock to them because they're used to being told with authority that there's, this is the thing.
Right.
And so it is a re-education to allow for complexity.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in the political realm, that's really getting us because we're not allowing for complexity.
Yeah.
We just want the answer.
Yeah.
You know, he says he can do it.
Right.
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 You know, but he says he's wrong. It's back and forth with none of that deliberation that you just applied.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if there's a way around that. You know, I think we have to elevate the whole willingness to spend, not just get motivated to participate, mm-hmm, but to be willing to participate in that uncomfortable way. I have to now study who I'm going to vote for.
I've got to read the news and read all these boring and complicated articles that are giving me conflicting information.
Right.
And how do I make sense? Who am I to decide?
Who is this guy who's writing this article? Who is this woman? What is her position?
Right.
What has she written in the past? Like a good example of this for me is David Brooks in the New York Times.
Yeah, he's an interesting fellow.
Yeah, because I always read his stuff and I'm like, yeah, right up until that last sentence.
Yeah.
You know? It's like he always comes to a conclusion that varies from how I've just read what he just laid out,
mm-hmm,
you know, like I like generally, mm-hmm, where he's coming from. I mean, he's all about this kindness and nobility and, you know,
mm-hmm,
society that's civil.
Mm-hmm.
But then he always goes down this conservative track with it that,
mm-hmm,
I don't mm-hmm really get.
Yeah.
So, and so in your, when you're teaching classes, it sounds like that's a part of what you're.
Yeah, I try not to give them
on the research end.
For one thing, I try not to give them. I mean, I do give actually multiple choice quizzes, but on the reading. But it's always I've written the questions. There's some that are like there's a clear answer, but I've deliberately written a few of them so that there's more than one right answer. One answer might be a better answer than the other one. And I've done that on purpose. This is a technique called team-based learning that I learned. I can't remember who it's actually a trademark method.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so they answer the question individually, then they answer it as a team, and they have permanent teams. So they go through and say, well, this is what I answer, and this is that I answer, and they try to come up with a better answer. And the team almost always does better, scores better.
Mm.
And then they can appeal. If they really feel that the answer was wrong, they can appeal based on either they found conflicting evidence or I've written the question badly.
Mm.
And I encourage them to appeal. They have nothing to lose by appealing and everything to gain because they can get back points.
Right.
And if it goes well, like it's this particular demographic, it's hard to get them to appeal. Whereas like, I think if you did this at Skidmore, you'd have people appealing all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know? They're much more entitled.
Mm-hmm.
So these students, they're just like, eh, oh well, I got an 80, so what?
Yeah.
So you have to go, no, it's good. Do appeal. Mm-hmm. I want you to appeal. And you should appeal question 8. I wrote that on purpose. So that, you know, and they're like, oh, okay. You know,
interesting.
I think that's nice for them too, because they've had to sit through so many tests that are,
right.
You know, where they're stupid and picayune and, obscure and badly written and, you know, and they've never had a chance to be heard on this.
Mm.
So that's encouraging them to question authority. But then, so they have to write their appeal. And I don't grant them always, because sometimes they have the, I actually agree with their appeal, but they've written it badly.
Mm.
So I'll hand it back to them and say, you know, you can rewrite this. I actually think you're right, but you did not convince me because you didn't give me any evidence.
Mm.
So you need to go back to the story and find the evidence and show me exactly on what line, you know, what page does it say this instead of that?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they'll take me up on that and do it again. And I think they get that point. So that's how you encourage that there's actually something at stake. There's like, you get good things if you start to dig in deeper and question things and try to prove things. And,
you know. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So what's been your experience of kids like at the end of class? Like, of course, most kids are just like, yahoo, we're done with this, but
yeah.
Do you get feedback from them?
Well, it's I do. It's not as rewarding as, you know, as you would like. You know, you'd sort of like everybody to flock around you and tell you're the greatest teacher ever in the world, you know.
Right.
And you don't necessarily get that, but I get an awful lot of compliments through the grapevine.
Mm.
You know, I hear an awful lot of like, oh yeah, my, you know. Usually it's the counselors tell me that everybody likes my courses, or every once in a while a student will let drop that, you know, so-and-so, their friend took me and recommended me.
Mm.
And, you know, again, this demographic, they're really conscious about brown nosing.
Mm.
So they don't compliment you a lot. They're pretty respectful. They don't challenge you a lot, but they also don't compliment you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've had some students, and actually some of my closest students that I actually developed like a friendship with, some of them started because I challenged them pretty hard.
Mm.
Like I just said, no, this is, you could do better.
Mm-hmm.
And they came and stormed at me and said, you know, you did this, you were rude and you did this wrong and you, you know, made me feel this small. And I was saying, I'm not saying you're not smart.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're smart. I'm saying you didn't do this, you know, as well as you could. You didn't do what I asked here, and I need you to do this and not that. And you can do this again. You can try again.
Yeah.
And then I've seen them, you know, get it and start to really engage and feel really good about themselves and feel really good about education. And so I've had some good friendships that have started from them actually being angry at me.
Mm-hmm.
and me being able to weather that and say, it's okay that you're angry at me. I understand, you know, and I'm not going to take it personally.
Right.
But
I'm the person in your life that teaches you that things matter.
Yeah. And sometimes they really don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
Or I'm the person who says, you may have convinced other teachers that you are brain dead, but, I saw the spark and I want you to express it, you know, and I'm not going to pass you unless you come to the table.
Yeah. Awesome.
So yeah, this one student, she laughed because she said, she always likes to quote me as saying that I said to the whole class, you know, it's not like in high school where I have to pass you, you know, I can, you know, if you don't do the work, you will fail. And I was like, oh, I didn't mean it to come across like that.
That's great. Please take a moment maybe even right now, to rate Peter's podcast. I've been having a little trouble lately because I'll tell someone about my podcast, and when we go to look it up on the various apps, it's not showing up, which means not enough people are saying, hey, I listened to it, and I know you are listening to it. So if you have an iPhone, it's literally right down at the bottom of the screen. If you go to your main viewer of the podcast app, click on some stars, say a few words if you want, and if you have an Android, you can always go to iTunes if there's not a clear way to do that. And on iTunes, find Peter's podcast, apparently by looking up my name, Peter Ferko, F-E-R-K-O, and then you'll find the podcast, and you can mark it from there. All right, thanks so much. Let's get this show on the road. Namaste.
Yeah, I make mistakes a lot as a teacher, but I think, again, the difference is that I'm willing to admit it.
Yeah, and who doesn't? I mean, it's not like a teacher is like some magical person.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about this in yoga training all the time.
Yeah.
You're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
You're going to say, turn your right foot this way, and it's supposed to be your left foot.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you can just own that,
or sometimes
you become human to the student.
Yeah. As I've embarrassed students, like I really try not to embarrass students, like especially because I want them to speak in class. So I try never to, you know, make fun of something they've said. But every once in a while, they'll say something that's so outrageous that you can't help it. You know, you're just like, what? You know, like a student said, you know, we were reading The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman. And she said, I don't think that novels should talk about religion. Mm. And it was hard. You know, I was like, what? And she felt terrible. She felt that I shamed her.
Aww.
And I it didn't matter how many times I apologized.
Yeah.
And just recently, I was trying to do the get out the vote kind of speech. So I was talking about, I'd read somewhere that if you tell students that that voting is a privilege, that doesn't motivate them.
Hmm.
Not just students, but people. If you tell people voting is a duty, they get it.
Hmm.
And so I'll say, you know, as an American citizen, you have one job and one job only, and that's to vote. The caveat is, though, in order to vote, you have to actually read the news to understand what to vote for, and that's a lot more work. But it is your duty. You can't have a democracy if the people are sleeping. So this time I thought, I'm going to start with a question. So I said, how many people think democracy is a good idea in a class of 20? And 3 people raised their hands.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, really? Really? Only 3 of you think democracy, like, what do you think is a better idea? And they were like, well, what do you mean? You know, we don't have a democracy. Blah, 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 you know? And I was like, well, that wasn't what I was asking. I'm saying, do you believe in the democratic ideal? That's what I'm asking. And one student said, I don't care. I just don't think it matters. I just think it doesn't really matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really? So like if there was like a fascist in power and he said that, and she was blonde, I said that all blonde people should go to jail, you would be like, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And that was bad. I should not have said that. As a teacher, I'm shaming her, and I have power and she doesn't. And she answered the question. And nobody else was answering the question. And there I was calling her out on her answer. So I kind of realized it halfway through. And I was like, oh, shit, what do I do? You know? So I thought, well, but then if I apologize in front of the class, then I'm calling attention to her again. So now what do I do? So at some point later in the class, I was checking notebooks and I came by and I said, I'm really sorry. I shamed you in public and I should not have done that. And she's like, oh, well, you know, it's okay. I said, well, I don't think it's okay. And I just, you know, sometimes when you're up there as a teacher, you don't really even know what you're saying. Like, you know, it just comes out and it's too late by the time it comes out. So would you like me to publicly apologize? Because I would like to.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, no, no, please don't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I can see from, you know, subsequent, you know, I can just see on her face that she smiles at me and I'm forgiven.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because the way that you describe that, sometimes when you're up there and you're teaching, stuff just comes out. Like, to me, that's something I try to cultivate.
Yeah.
Is this flow of intuitional wisdom flowing through. And what I would suggest as a potential what happened that day is mm-hmm. that she really needed to have that interaction with you mm-hmm. in both parts.
Yeah.
And yeah. that now she may have so much more respect from you and maybe gain something hearing someone yeah. apologize to her that lets her understand how to do that in her
yeah.
own life.
Right.
And
right.
such, you know?
Yeah.
So I think
yeah,
if we're just working at our best in all the moments.
Yeah, treating people with kindness in those daily yeah. interactions and respect, you know.
Right. But even to oneself, like when we feel bad about doing something, the best we can do is just say, oh, well, I would do that differently next time, or what
yes.
can I do about it now?
Yeah.
And not then shame yourself about it.
Right. Oh,
you know?
That's huge, because I would say 15 years ago, when I was much more depressed and much more sort of in my stuff, I would have felt such shame for what I did that all my energy would have just sunk down. And then I would have I might have even gotten angry at her.
Yeah.
And then I would have gone away and gone back to my office just feeling terrible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so my ability to quickly say, oh, I'm so sorry, was because I didn't feel shame.
Right.
Because I accepted that I made a mistake and that it's okay to make mistakes. And this,
yeah.
I think it's the same thing with racism, frankly. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, again, 20 years ago, it was like, oh my God, I did something racist, you know? Mm-hmm. And now it's like, of course I did something racist. It would be really hard not to be racist being raised in this society, mm-hmm. you know, the way it is, with all the messages, all the subliminal message we're getting. It's hard not to be sexist. And it doesn't make me a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
What I need to do is acknowledge it mm-hmm. and go, oops, you know?
Yeah. And it becomes then a practice.
Yeah, I told, I had a group of students who are African American, and I was telling them how I went down to Albany, and Albany is much more diverse than Saratoga, is very, very white. That's when mm-hmm. you said people with deep living, I kind of laughed because it's like, well, mm-hmm. a lot of privilege up here, and it's very, very white up here. Go down to Albany, a lot more people of color and nationalities, and but I went down to Central Avenue, which is kind of sketchy. It just looks sketchy. It's dirtier. There's people drinking beer in the morning, you know, on the sidewalk, and, you know, a lot more people of color. And I kind of looked around, and I felt this a little bit of, you know, fear. And one of my African-American students said, did you lock your doors? And I said, I thought about it. But then I caught it. I caught the thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, I have been in white land too long, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's all, you know, it's just like catch the thought and turn it around.
Yeah.
Send it back out.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you made this nice segue to one of the other things I wanted to chat about, which is, you know, your whole family is very engaged in the political realm
mm-hmm.
in your town and in the mm-hmm. nation. And I've watched that be something that's both a source of pride and inspiration, but also something that's overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. And just be curious to know where you are on that right now in this moment.
I think it's been most overwhelming for Charlie because he took up the chairing of the City Democratic Committee, and you know, he did that for 6 years, and he's been on that committee for probably 10 years, and you know, sat through a couple of different chairs. Then people started kind of cultivating him. They're like, oh, you're such a nice guy, and you know, you're so fair, and you know, you should be the chair. And so then he stepped into it, and he started, you know, with the help of really some very good executive committee members, they started really building the committee. So first they wrote out their kind of their charter, their set of rules, and then they started really conducting the meetings in this very kind of patterned way mm-hmm. so that everybody could learn the patterns. Basically, mm-hmm. Is it Robert's Rules?
Robert's Rules.
Yeah. Which, you know, though seem annoyingly formalistic, they really are designed to make sure that everybody gets a say mm-hmm. and that you make decisions, that you build consensus. And so the committee now has gone, you know, it's full, you know, every seat is filled. It's got subcommittees that are all functioning and getting work done. It's really probably the strongest committee, and it's stronger than the county committee. Mm. It's probably the one of the strongest committees in upstate New York in terms of its functionality and membership.
You can learn more about Lolly Davidson and find links to some of her publications at lollydavidson.com. That's LalleDavidson.com.
After 6 years, he finally had to step away from it. You know, bit by bit, he sort of made sure he could train somebody to replace him, and then he's slowly pulling out. But it just reminds me of something that Al Gore said, you know, when he lost his bid for presidency, and he said, you know, politics is toxic. Mm-hmm. And there's a man you can see that he has made a decision that he could do more good, you know, for the world, staying away from these public offices. And that's sad. So I don't know, you asked that question of what's the impact, or is that what the question was?
Well, sort of where do you stand on things now? You know, you've been on sort of both sides of how it feels to be mm-hmm. so engaged.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just wondering what your current feelings are about that. And it sounds like finding balance is the answer.
Yeah. And I think, what I was saying to Charlie is that I think that if you're going to take on that leadership role, you really have to cultivate detachment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to, and I don't know how, I don't know that I could, you mm-hmm. know, I stepped into a leadership role briefly as the president of our faculty union and found that being in the limelight and having all this attack coming from your own constituents, not even from your supposed opponents,
mm-hmm.
It felt a little bit like pillory, mm-hmm. like being publicly humiliated mm-hmm. and publicly punished. And I found that my ego could not stand up to it at that time in my life. And mm-hmm. so I had to step away from it, just couldn't do it. I thought I could. I thought I was mm-hmm. strong enough, and I wasn't. And Charlie was strong enough for 6 years, but it wore him down.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see that it was, toxic is a really good word for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what the key is. I know that's the goal. The goal is to look at people like, look, I said, try to think of them as the ducks in the park. Have you ever sat and watched ducks? They're, you know, they're just trotting around the park, and some are sitting, and one duck will come up to one that's sitting, and they'll be pecking the grass, this other duck, and he'll come and he'll peck the grass right under the breast of the one who's sitting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he could peck anywhere else, but he's got to have that grass right under the breast of that duck.
Right.
And I was like, that's what people are like. They're just a little bit troublemakers, you know, mm-hmm. and they're just, I said, so try to see it as like, they're just ducks. They're just quacking. This is what people do.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. You know, people question authority. People criticize authority. People blame authority. And it doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah. I was just thinking the flip side of that thing, that because I'm just as guilty as anybody of doing that. Like when there is someone in authority,
even
if it's a colleague, I am inclined to sort of see that role instead of the person and lay blame there.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe a good practice to start to see those people as also people. And, you know, I tried to do that with Trump, you know, to try to figure out like what is behind this guy, you know, and I've come to what I think is a satisfactory place where I feel I understand him better. I mm-hmm. see him as a person and I understand him better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want him as our president.
No.
But at least I'm not vilifying him as this.
Right.
You know.
Right. He doesn't deserve to die. He doesn't deserve to suffer. He's just a sick.
He's no longer an effigy in my mind. He's a troubled boy.
He's a troubled boy. Yeah, exactly.
So.
Troubled boy and possibly, you know, with a little brain dysfunction. You know?
Yeah. But yeah, that's a good way to put it. So there's that, and then there's the just the challenge of like convincing people. Like in your university, you're in a position of
authority
where you are the voice of authority speaking, and so people are that little bit more inclined to listen to you. But when it's trying to convince people on the street or trying to do it in phone calls or that's trickier.
Well, you know, it's kind of good training. So yes, I've been phone banking for Tedra Cobb she's running for Congress in the 21st, which isn't even my district, but it was like she's running against a Republican who's really been a puppet and she hasn't been here. She hasn't lived in this area. She doesn't listen to her constituents at all. So I hate the phone calling, but I'm like always happy when it's an answering machine. But you know, there's a script, and the script really makes it very clear that you ask, you know, are you interested in hearing about this? And if they say yes, then you tell them. If they say no, you say, okay, thank you very much. Mm. And you move on. Mm. You don't try to convince them. Mm. And that's been really instructive because I'm always like, okay, let me see if I can convince you. You know, so the idea is you're just trying to get the word out to as many people as possible. You're trying to find the people who are willing to listen and maybe, you know, willing to really truly consider, and then give them the information they need. And the people who are against you, you just don't bother them. Mm-hmm. You thank them and get out of their way as fast as possible and move on, because you've got, so that you have the time to get to the people that you can speak to. Mm-hmm. You know?
Who would be more likely to be motivated.
Right. And then you have to accept that, like, you're going to get, I think, out of 50 phone calls, maybe you're going to talk to maybe 5 people or maybe 2 people. And out of those 2 people, you may change the mind of, you know, one, but not even one half, you know? Mm-hmm. So it ends up being like 50 calls to get one vote is what they say. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of calls. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I kind of try to do the drop in the bucket. Okay, drop in the bucket. If we all bring our drops and drop them in the bucket, it'll get full. Mm-hmm. And then Charlie keeps saying, yeah, but if everybody, but they're not, everybody isn't doing it. So why are, you know, you don't have to do it either. And then I think, yeah, but then there's some, I can't think who it is. I don't know if it's Sartre or you have to act as if you have to do the right thing. You have to think about it. Maybe it's Kant who said, you have to ask yourself, if everybody did this, would this work? You know, like when you're thinking about something, like I often cut corners like this, the walkway goes at right angles and I'm going to cut across the grass. Mm-hmm. And so you have to ask yourself, but if everybody cut across the grass and there was a path here, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? And if you decided it's a bad thing, then you should not walk across that grass, even though just you walking across the grass isn't going to make a difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, so he says you have to think of things that way. And the only problem with that is then we should all pretty much stop driving cars and stop eating anything that's packaged in anything right now. Because, so, you know, you have to take that all with a grain of salt.
Yeah, and the world by its nature is going to be filled with stuff, filled with good and evil. You know, that is the nature of the world. Yeah. And so I think that it boils down to this individual thing, our nature in walking about is individual. Mm-hmm. So what can I individually do right now? You know, and you've found this certain way of engaging with the politics around you. That's what you can do.
Yeah. And I find actually the thing that I struggle with, though, is that, you know, am I doing enough? Should I be doing more? And that's a constant struggle, you know, because I could be doing more than I do, but there comes a point where I say, but I really need to rest, or I need to watch TV. That sounds so crazy, but I do, you know, there's a time of the day when I need to shut the rest of the world out and I need to shut my brain off and go into La La Land for an hour or two.
Lolly Land,
right. And, would that time be better used, you know, reading or making more phone calls? I don't know, because I start to kind of malfunction if I don't take care of myself.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I started a practice around some of that stuff too, where it's like if I'm staying aware of my connections with all of me, right? Mm-hmm. The Atman, the highest self, and the, mm-hmm. and the individual personality, and the puppy, and the wife, and all those things. As long as I'm staying in awareness and not running off into some story or delusion about it, I feel like, okay, this is a potential precious moment, mm-hmm. you know? So mm-hmm. even doing something like saying, you know what, I'm going to give myself permission to watch a television show now, you know, it can be like a practice. It's mm-hmm. like you just made it right. for you. You
right. know, like if you're watching it going, oh, I should be doing something else, yeah. then you're really, that's not helping
then you're
anybody.
Not in the moment.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
now, you know, a feeling of inadequacy or something.
Yeah. I
know?
Think there's a lot to that. And probably the more you do that, the less, you know, I probably wouldn't need to watch 2 hours. Probably only need an hour.
Yeah. To know? Actually let yourself enjoy it. You
yeah.
know, the one
yeah.
really great cookie instead of the bag of, these are low fat cookies.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But the, you know, and then you have to use discernment about it because
right.
obviously that could lead you down the path of destruction as well.
But yeah, and there's also self-indulgence. And this mm-hmm. is, you know, I remember them saying that about, you know, my generation, that we were the me generation. And we were coming at the end of the great generation. You know, my mom was from the great generation. And the thing that about the great generation, so they were the ones that were of coming of age during World War II, they were... I think they did sacrifice themselves way more than we do. Like my mother, you know, she raised 5 kids while working full time and then took us to other countries. Now she has extraordinary energy and mm-hmm. I do think she has more energy than most people. But she says to me, Lolly, I never asked myself, did I want to do the dishes? I never asked myself, do I want to change the sheets? I just did it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. my, you know, me, the me generation says, do I want to do the dishes? Mm-hmm. No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this whole argument with ourselves about the dishes. So, you know, there's something to be said for that kind of, that kind of mentality of like, this has to be done and I'm not going to ask myself and I'm just going to do it. On the other hand, being, I have to say, being the child of that person
yeah.
was really hard because mm-hmm. she never asked me what I wanted
mm-hmm.
and she never... I didn't feel that she really saw me even or recognized who I was. I mean, and it came right down to like, she didn't even ask me what I wanted to do with my life. It was kind of ordained. So I found that really hard. And, you know, I think I'm not putting my depression at her door because I think there's some of it, it's just chemical. But certainly it that wasn't what I needed. You know, as a young person, what I needed was, you know, who are you? Mm-hmm. What do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
What are your feelings? You're feeling sad? Oh, let's talk about your sadness. And her attitude was, well, just don't feel sad.
Right.
Just be positive, you know,
right.
power of positive thinking. And it was the opposite of what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I'm older and sitting on the other side of that, I can see the sense in what she was saying, you know, that there is to some extent you can make choices. But you can't skip over that part, right?
Right.
I think you have to ask yourself,
right.
what do you want? What do you feel? I think that's better because if you're doing the, I didn't even ask myself whether I want to do the dishes. I don't think she asked herself whether she wanted to have 5 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if she had, she probably wouldn't have had 5.
Mm-hmm.
She probably would have had 2.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I just was reading in this book about, you know, compulsive eating. And he was saying the problem with those diets, you know, the really strict diets is that if you're going from mindless overeating to mindless undereating, it's the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's this mindlessness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to work. So naturally, as soon as you go off that strict habitual, regimen where you didn't have to think about the food, naturally you're going to overeat because it's just the flip side of the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's not connecting
mm-hmm.
mindfully.
Yeah.
Wow, how'd I get from politics to overeating?
Stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
Luckily it was conscious consciousness.
Yeah.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good place to pause so I can get on the road back to
all
New
right.
York and
yeah.
we can do our stuff. You
yeah.
moved your clock, right?
Yeah, it's over here now.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, it's been wonderful to visit with you and to enjoy the play that you wrote.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us the name of the play.
Uprising. About the Polish uprising, which is not to be confused with the Jewish ghetto uprising that happened the year before.
Mm-hmm.
So in Nazi-occupied Germany, in Nazi-occupied Poland in Warsaw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you co-wrote this play.
With two teenagers.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It was awesome. And I really think the three of us, I loved collaborating. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was hard, but... I do think we produced something that none of us could have produced alone. I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, you know, do you think this is such a good play? Do you think you're going to write another one? I was like, well, not unless, are you volunteering to collaborate with me?
Yeah. And the run of Uprising just concluded yesterday. I got to see the final production.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. We actually had a tour. We had a run.
Yes.
Yeah. So...
And that run is over, and so we'll see. There's potential that it could get some.
We're sending it around here and there to, you know, some contests and things like that. So who knows? Maybe somebody, some other theater company will pick it up or something.
Yeah.
So there has been interest.
Yeah. Great. Well, I'm going to put a link to some contacts of yours in the show notes because you're quite a prolific writer, and you've got a lot of stuff out and about. And
I'm not prolific, but well, that's okay.
Relative to some and not to others, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah. Wonderful to talk with you as always. Yeah. Okay.
All right, bye.
I hope you've liked this edition of Peter's podcast. I always love talking with Lolly. She has such great insights. If you like the podcast, please rate it. You can do that on an app or on iTunes. Please support me on patreon.com. That's patreon.com/Peter's podcast. And support at any level you like. You can always start and stop and change. So it's super easy to do, and it keeps me from having to run advertisements on the podcast. Until next week, namaste.